have someone turn on the projector. This may be as confusing as the sermon is going to be. That's okay. Well, let me get started with the talk anyway. Creativity, that's the theme. My non-dictionary definition of creativity is the title of this sermon, 1 + 1 = 1. That's not a comprehensive definition, and it certainly would not satisfy Webster's, and it needs to be applied with a very loose flexibility. But still, I find it handy to use. Nature shows great creativity in taking a gas, hydrogen, another gas, oxygen, and combining them to make a liquid. Could you imagine gas plus gas equaling a liquid? That's incredibly inventive, although there's no person actually doing it. Then there's J.S. Bach, who takes only 12 notes, no more, and creates a rhythm, places the notes in selected order, and out comes this whole array of organ masterpieces. 1 + 1 = 1. Then there's the teen who takes a Q-tip out of her purse to retrieve a dime that fell between the plastic cushions in the local eatery, a coin that is now needed to pay her bill. And she finds that by taking the Q-tip out of her purse, she cannot reach down and get the dime. But by putting the Q-tip on the end of a straw, she can reach down far enough to push the dime out. 1 + 1, that's creative. What causes a person to be creative? And I think we all are creative in some ways at some point. What is the catalyst? I believe it's need. Bach, as the head of music of a church in Leipzig for 28 years of his life in the first half of the 18th century, needed to write a cantata every single Sunday, and then assemble the singers and the instrumentalists and practice to sing the cantata on Sunday. The teen normally might have walked away from that lowly dime. However, she needed it to pay for her food. Necessity for Bach and for the teen was the catalyst for a creative response. And I believe that out of need, each one of us finds creativity at times. I want to return to this idea of need a little later as the basis for creativity. But first, I want to say something about religion and creativity. And it's the subtitle of this talk, An Oxymoronic View of Religion and Creativity, that describes creativity and religion. For one area that is particularly skimpy of creativity in life is religion. They don't go well together. We might describe it as that proverbial mixer of oil and water. Connor Wood, a PhD candidate at Boston University in Religion and Science, writes that studies show that people who are part of religious institutions are less creative than others. Now, why would that be? Well, he goes on to say that group life depends on people sharing the same system of meaning. And this congregation does that. If you turn around and face what is on the wall and back, you notice that there are statements that this congregation affirms. And what would happen if somebody came and said, oh, that needs to be changed? How receptive would you be to changing? And you can see why then a church or an institution tends to be resistant to creativity or change. For creativity is about breaking old patterns or seeing new things or arranging old things in a new way. So religion as a community is in the business of maintaining and protecting existing patterns, whereas the creative mind approaches the world to break existing patterns. Such a lack of creativity among religious leaders is the result that comes from professional education as well. For what is the education of a minister? Well, ancient books are studied. The Bible, the Vedas, the Quran, the writings of Emerson. And those ancient books become the norm for contemporary truth and contemporary living. In other words, the past becomes the guidance and the determination of the present. Sermons reach back to writings of the past to inform the present. And then when history is studied, it is also studied in order to inform the present, as well as doctrine. Contrast that with the education of a mathematician. How many mathematicians read the 13 books of Euclid's Elements? Or physicists who don't read the 3 books of Newton's Principia? William Willimon, a Methodist bishop, formerly in charge of 600 ministers in northern Alabama, said that half his time was spent protecting congregations from toxic pastors, and the other half of his time was protecting pastors from toxic congregations. He said that he removed 30 pastors from ministry between 2004 and 2012. And then he had this to say, "It's ironic. Most of the pastors that I had to remove, I did with great regret because they were some of the most effective and creative pastors. It was their creativity and innovative spirit that got them into trouble. Many of the dismissed had demonstrated creativity, but we learned that this feature, their innovative spirit, got them into trouble." Well, of course, there are exceptions, and I'm going to hold myself up as one. One other illustration I wanted to add here to this. And it was an observation made by my wife. The church I served in Houston had an inordinate number of engineers and scientists. And she noticed that at the coffee tea conversation time after worship, the scientists and the engineers would be leaning toward each other, faces exhibiting curiosity, anticipation, intensity, and excitement. They were sharing new ideas, new procedures, future possibilities. Whereas my wife noticed that in ministers' gatherings, although it was good-hearted, friendly fellowship, there was an absence of curiosity, anticipation, and excitement. creativity includes the rejection of established norms for the new, whereas religion works at maintaining established patterns. And as I said earlier, like any rule, there are exceptions. And I want to describe my own creativity in religion as a possibility, and not something I want to impose on you, but at least as a way that a mind can work, even in religion. Perhaps because of my early career path in science, in a research lab, my approach to religion, belief, and the job of a minister always contained an element of questioning, even skepticism. I said earlier that creativity came out of need. Bach's need to write a cantata each week to get paid, and the teens need to retrieve 10 cents. But my need, expressed in 6 decades of my professional life, has been a way of using legitimately the language of religion in light of my core understanding of the world as presented in the findings of science. My crunch was this. In my job as a minister, I had to preach regularly and engage in the rites and rituals of the church using the traditional language of religion. And yet, the traditional language of religion is based on a view of the pre-Copernican flat world that I just did not believe in. So how do you pull those together? In such a world, what does one do with a God in heaven, a virgin birth, and a body rising from the dead? Did it make any sense to speak of the will of God when the idea of a deity operating as a traffic control manager for the world and sticking a finger into human affairs with miracles once in a while seems quite absurd? Can traditional religious language be used in the absence of the reference of a God in whom we live and move our have our being, to use a biblical phrase? So my issue, my need, was to find a way of using life-transforming words, and I believe that's what the language of religion is, with a scientific world that denies the reality of those words. What has made this so difficult is the prevailing view of religion that literalizes the Bible. Ancient Jews told stories and did not deal in propositional truths. But Christianity took a wrong turn when it got into the hands of the Gentile Greeks and Romans. Now, for example, a wonderful story of creation told around the campfires of old becomes a literal truth. And we find that tension still working itself out in public schools in the conflict between creation science and evolutionary science. Well, the end of my creative efforts that I want to share with you today has been an embrace of traditional religious, mainly Christian language, as an expression of human and not a supernatural experience. So what does theology look like in a non-theistic world? That is, if one assumes there's no God up there or out there, is it still possible to use the richness of traditional language? And for 28 years, that is what I worked on. Well, personally and professionally for me, it had to be done. And I want to share with you the result of my lifetime of attempting to solve my need. Okay, let's go to the... The first word that I want to do is incarnation, and it really came alive for me in a poem by Robert Frost called Kitty Hawk. You're not going to find this poem of Robert Frost in any anthology because it's a very long poem. It contains a lot of references to ancient mythology, which slows down most of us as readers. But in that poem, in speaking about the venture into the air by Orville and Wilbur Wright, Frost wrote, "Then I saw it all. Pulpiteers will censure our instinctive venture into what they call the material when we took that fall from the apple tree. But God's own descent into flesh was meant as a demonstration that the supreme merit lay in risking spirit in substantiation." The supreme merit lay in risking spirit in substance. And I realize that this word incarnation is not a word that needs to be disposed of, because it really points to a perennial human activity, risking one's spirit in substance. The person who has a dream and devotes time and money in starting a new business is engaged in incarnation, pouring herself or himself into a dream. The person who has a dream of life with another person and speaks the words, "From this day forward, engaging in the great adventure of marriage," is risking spirit in substantiation. The person writing an editorial or a letter to the editor expressing an unpopular political view can be risking her or his spirit in substantiation. So incarnation is a word that developed, that developed in a particular theological belief. But once it's removed from that theological framework, it can also describe one of the truly exciting human activities. The risk that we take in expressing our dreams, our loves, in the world around. And I have not found another word that captures that spirit, that special quality of involvement. Okay. I cringe when I hear and keep hearing that Jesus died for our sins. The idea that we are such miserable people and are offensive to the purity of Almighty God, that God had to take action and provide a means for us to become acceptable, and God did that by sending Jesus on earth to die in our place, is truly offensive. I would get around that when I would write liturgy by saying the phrase, "Jesus died because of our sins." And I believe that. In the same way that I believe that Martin Luther King Jr. died because of our nation's sins. And I believe that there are people who sacrifice their lives for others. So the word sacrifice is able to elevate death into a larger meaning, not just being killed or being assassinated. Okay. There's another word that I found that I could transmute into something of meaning, even though it no longer had connection with some kind of, no longer had a divine connection, and that's the word sin. If any doctrine receives the good housekeeping seal of disapproval, it is the doctrine of sin. However, extracted from the supernatural theistic God and from the literal ring of the creation story in Genesis 1, I find a belief in sin to be a sure guideline through the morass of this world. It's a reminder to me that there's a perversity in humans that wends its way through all of us at times. For example, all these honorable people who are creating misdeeds. They do wrong. But that's sort of a weak word when you consider just what's happening in sexual affairs in the last year or so. I don't know if you saw the movie Spotlight, but you remember the it's about the sexual abuse and cover-up scandal in the Boston Archdiocese. And of the hundreds of boys, mostly boys and some girls, who were sexually abused. And then you have former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky, convicted on 45 counts of child sex abuse, and dragging down the lionized coach, Joe Paterno. And then you have Dennis Hassett, the longest speaker of the House of Representatives, convicted of bank fraud, but behind it was his sexual violation of students early in his coaching career. And now you've got Ken Starr, resigned his presidency of Baylor because of inattention to a case of rape. Well, that's been in the paper just in the last year. How do you talk about this? And it seems to me the word sin is a powerful word to talk about it, because it's evil. But we don't have the language, and so I find the word sin very helpful as I look at the world and try and understand and describe what's going on. Or I don't know if you know about the American Red Cross, an organization that is chartered by Congress and is out to do good. When the earthquake in 2010 happened in Haiti, the Red Cross raised almost $500 million. And they were going to do a lot of work down there. It was discovered by investigators that actually 6 houses were put up. And the Red Cross is just one organization where money goes in huge amounts into administration and also into benefits for employees. You think of the Veterans Administration in this. Well, how do we talk about institutions that are so evil and so pervasive? I don't think we have the language, but when I think of the word sin, I have a word to talk about it that talks about it in a serious way. But it's just not out there, it's in us as well. Some of you are old enough to remember the Mills Brothers. They had a song, one of their signature songs, "You always hurt the one you love, the one you shouldn't hurt at all." Is there any parent who hasn't hurt a child? Any child that hasn't hurt a parent? Any spouse that hasn't hurt one spouse? There's a perversity in us at times that really does hurt other people, and quite deliberately so. What kind of language do we have for that? Well, I found the word sin to be a helpful word for that. Lord Acton famously said that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And don't we see this continually now in our newspapers about some of our state officials? So the word sin not only is a way for me to talk about, or at least I don't really use the word very often, but to think about what's going on in our society and within myself, and it also keeps me from becoming too disappointed when others don't measure up to the standards that I think they ought to be held to. One more word, resurrection. And this is a favorite word of mine. I don't believe in dead bodies coming to life. The resurrection of Jesus and Lazarus before him are not to be read literally. My shorthand way of understanding resurrection is to say that Jesus was killed and he rose again in the hearts and minds of his followers. That Jesus was killed, buried, and he rose again in the hearts and minds of his followers. And don't we do that every year with Martin Luther King Jr.? Every January, every February, we resurrect him and remind ourselves of who he was and what happened to him. Well, let me say a little more about resurrection, since I find it such a powerful word in which to think about the world around us. There are individuals I know, and as a minister I've certainly heard the stories of a lot of people who have been physically and sexually abused in childhood and as adults, as men and women. And what does that assault do to people? Well, it builds walls and destroys trust. And for some, that closing off of life is permanent. But for most, there is a slow rebuilding of trust in others. And the person finds himself or herself open to the experiences of the world once again. How do we talk about that when a person is so abused, and yet the next day gets out of bed and put one foot in front of the other and enters into life again? I think that word is resurrection. It talks about death, and out of death, real life. There are individuals I know to whom the word cancer has been spoken. At one time, you will remember, it almost was an automatic death sentence. And hearing the word can still send some people into depression. Most, though, these days, face their own death and affirm life, and even join the growing number of cancer survivors. How do we talk about such life affirmation in the face of death? I think we have a word, at least the word that I use is resurrection. It's one thing to face one's own death, but what can be even more difficult is the death of a friend, a lover, a parent, a spouse, or a child, and especially a child. Such a devastating experience can rip open one's emotions and shed any complacency about the goodness of life. And yet, people will put one foot in front of the other and move through the days in a slow, increasing affirmation of life. To go from death to life is resurrection. And there are other kinds of deaths. The death that comes at the end of a marriage, getting fired from a job, the end of a dream. And such deaths erode, even demolish, feelings of self-respect and self-worth. And yet people pick up the pieces of their lives and move on, affirming life. How do we talk about such affirmation in death? And I think we have the word resurrection. Then there are those fatal wounds that we administer to ourselves, the times that we betray our own values, shortcut our own ethics, cut corners with our own consciences. And that can lead at times to self-loathing, even overwhelm a person. And yet people do come to terms with that, find acceptance by others and forgiveness of self. And how do we talk about that kind of life when one has betrayed oneself? I label such power resurrection. And so we carry these wounds around with us. And yet we move on one step after the other in our lives. Resurrection isn't believing, as we say to children when scared, now, everything's going to turn out all right. Because there are real wounds and real death. And I don't know that we ever get completely over these, but we do live through them, and in the process become resurrected. Thus, resurrection gives me a way of looking at life and death It gives me a point of view which includes, in addition to survival, a sense of purpose, a point from which to protest against the injustices of this world. And so what I have found in religious language is a power that talks about human life in a significant way. The exuberant risk that humans take in investing themselves in organizations and other people. It's an incarnation. The sacrifice of some on behalf of others. The seriousness of the manipulation of others and, upon disclosure, the destruction of trust, sin, and the power of individuals to leave the dead husk of their past life and move with new life into the present and the future, resurrection. Now, I'm not asking you to accept what I struggled with and had to come to terms with, but my task was to find some way of using religious language in a way that didn't depend upon the traditional flat earth theology. And let me end with this. A Zen master once said that we all live in a box, and the walls of the box consist of who we think we are and what we think life should be. The box is a product of the culture in which we grow, the influences of family and friends, our experiences, and all are ground together in the core of who and what we are. And Buddhists would say that the box is a contrivance, it's not reality, it's a fantasy, a delusion. But we live in it anyway, because stepping outside of it is quite unthinkable for most of us. In our box, we look at the world around us through language. We use language to label, to judge, to manipulate. And what I have found is that theological language is a way of identifying, but also giving significance to events. And I have gone through just four of the words that I have found meaningful. I guess what I would ask you to do is to be creative in your own way, to look at the kind of words that you use to look at the world around, to understand that world, to judge that world, to manipulate that world. For creativity is the way of taking one and putting the two together in a way that is unique, but it's very personal. Creativity is a means of knowing who we are and what we're about. It's a way of understanding how we interact with the world. I would recommend that you begin to, or you at least think of taking and being creative in terms of your own understanding. How is it that you look at the world? And what words are there that you use to understand and to judge and manipulate the world around?